Generals of Mages before that. This has been Ear Buddies on WMFO 91.5 FM Tufts Reform Radio. Up next, Jeff with Socialist Alternative Radio, some eye-opening, thought-provoking, consciousness-raising discussion of social and economic issues. And I'll just play some Beatles while he gets set up.
Fade out some Beatles there, but we're going to come back here with John Lennon in a minute, and we're going to talk about some other things, non-Beatles, after that. You're listening to MFO, WMFO Medford, that's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial-Free Community-Based Radio, and we are a little subset of that community base. We're going to be Socialist Alternative Radio for the next 2 hours here at WMFO. That's talk and music from a working-class, democratic socialist perspective. Socialist Alternative Radio. We're here every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out at WMFO.org by computer while we're live streaming, or you can just check us out at the archive function. Go to schedules, click on Socialist Alternative Radio. And I'm your host today. My name's Jeff, and we're going to get into the gun control protests and much more today. But first, in order to get a little paperwork done, we're going to do a song that we normally often end the show with, Imagine by John Lennon, just to get you in the mood for our show. and then we'll be back. So give it a listen, and we'll be right back.
Sky.
And that was John Lennon with Imagine from Lennon Lives, I believe is the Lennon Legend, sorry, the very best of John Lennon, an old CD. And as we mentioned earlier, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we have a lot to talk about today. I'll be your host. My name's Jeff. And if you're a regular listener, you know that we wide-ranging show here. We are a little bit unlike, well, a lot unlike, I'd say, other show progressive radio shows or left-wing radio shows. There aren't that many, but there are a few. Usually at the left side of your dial, your radio dial, at the college stations here or there, a few left-wing shows around. But we are really left-wing. we are basically, yes, very serious about the need for social transformation to a socialist society and economy, and not just sort of trying to redefine capitalism in a way that makes it appear to be some sort of socialist something or other, which is pretty popular right now. There's socialism as a whole is getting more and more popular as a concept, but that concept is very elastic, very gets stretched into ways that are unrecognizable to real socialists, real Marxists. So, for example, Bernie Sanders, who has the label of socialist, even though he really gave that up back in the early 90s, and we can talk about that. We've talked about it on the show before, but I know that from like direct, direct experience interaction with his politics and so on. But basically, you know, Sanders gave a speech when he ran for president unveiling, you know, because he'd been asked so many times about socialism. Usually he didn't bring it up. Someone brings it up on, you know, calls him a socialist and tries to, at the beginning of his campaign, especially in 2016, they're trying to red bait him a lot, 2015, 2016. It didn't work, which is really great. And Sanders also never, you know, really, he never trash socialism, which was good, as far as I know. But he also tried to redefine it at a certain press conference that he had called just for the, to, you know, sort of say, this is my version of socialism. It got somewhat, some coverage, not a lot, in the corporate media. And Sanders then proceeded to, you know, call people like FDR and even Johnson socialists. These are the presidents, American U.S. presidents I'm talking about. And that was a little too much, obviously, for a lot of people. Others just sort of swallowed it and just moved on. And, of course, Johnson and FDR and Kennedy and any other Democratic Party icon that you can pull up are far from socialist. They are pronounced capitalists. Remember, Obama was called a socialist by the right wing, and the right wing apparently doesn't read very much because Obama put out a book early in his campaign where he, among other things, extolled and promoted the ideas of Ronald Reagan and thought and said Reagan was a great president, blah, blah, blah. And then when Obama's in power and he gives a huge bailout to the big banks, the big corporations during the so-called Great Recession and afterwards, then there should have been no question in anyone's mind that he wasn't. You don't hear that much, to be frank. You don't hear many. I think people were calling Obama a socialist. I think they backed off from that a little bit in some circles. But you know, it's ideas like that are still out there. That so you know, labeling socialism something it is not. And calling liberalism an all encompassing thing that somehow stretches into the socialism. And really, there's some very key ways you can tell the difference between sort of liberal ideas that ultimately are there to serve capitalism and capital, and socialist ideas which are there to transform society into a non-capitalist society. And there's the segue into the first idea is the political party, organization, philosophy, ideas, program, are they essentially anti-capitalist or not? There's one big tip-off whether you're talking about real socialism or not. And you'd be surprised at how confusing that discussion can get among people who will call mild social reforms, you know, sort of the essence of socialism, or will call government-run entities socialist entities within a capitalist economy, and that they just really aren't. They're still controlled by the political and economic power of capitalism within a capitalist economy. Even if they're publicly owned, for example, Amtrak, let's say, is Amtrak socialist? No, it's not socialist. Amtrak is run by a government controlled by two capitalist political parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And they try to run Amtrak like a business. They don't try to run it as a right or a service. And Amtrak has a board of directors, unelected, like a corporation. You know, there's so many ways that it's not like what a socialist economy would be like, which would be an extension of democracy, real democracy, not what we experience, but real voting on things that matter, into economic decisions, major economic decisions that affect the lives of thousands and thousands of people on a regional, but also state, federal, international level. Democratic planning of the economy is the essence of socialism, always has been. And if we ever achieve it, it will prove to be the first time we'll have real democracy, because you can't say you have political democracy, but the economy you can't touch, you know, or you can only touch through regulations that can be undone, you know, with a stroke of a pen, as is happening now with the Trump regime. So either you have enshrined into the workings of the economy democratic planning for human need, or you have enshrined a very authoritarian system, the corporate system, with no planning, basically the anarchy of profit and competition and so on, profit mongering and profit chasing. And you have within the institutions that control that system, no democracy at all. I mean, there's nothing more authoritarian than a corporation, despite the facade of shareholders and in publicly held corporations and the facade of elected board of directors. The election is controlled by those with the most shares. And so it's a self-perpetuating elite, which, by the way, is a good analogy for the U.S. So-called democracy in general, if you think about it. But rather than get into that so much right now, as we have before, right now we're just using that to explain, you know, right now socialism, what socialism really is, and the fact that there are all sorts of different ideas of socialism floating around right now. But in general, the trend is towards increasing popularity through, you know, you've seen in polling data and so on, through socialism, or at least you could say scientifically, less antipathy towards the word socialism, and it's an embrace of socialism in many ways by increasing numbers of younger people, so-called millennials, you know, the youth in general, but even among other sections of society, sort of respect for socialism, misunderstandings and all, is increasing, and that's overall a good thing, obviously. And we have a situation now where, because of the growing inequality of capitalism, which is going to be hopefully a big topic today on our show, that you know, people are still really loath to come up with, you know, use the C word a lot, capitalism, especially still loath to use the S word, socialism, as any sort of possible future way out of the problems that capitalism, that are intractable, that are endemic to capitalism, that are face, you know, creating a situation where humanity's future, you know, as a species being able to live in the without destroying the environment, not in humanity as a whole, but the corporations and so on, human life, sustainable human life in a sustainable environment for humanity is being really, really called into question. And I'm putting that mildly because I'm not trying to give a gloom and doom scenario. I think just scientifically, I think that's true. What happens, though, is that it's just ingrained sort of through a lot of brainwashing, basically, that there must be technological ways out under capitalism to save, you know, human compatibility with the environment, to save the human species as being able to live in this environment. And I would say that's extremely utopian, wishful thinking, whereas socialists are accused of utopian thinking. So it's the world turned upside down, basically, in a lot of cases now, when you are looking at what capitalism really is, as opposed to what we're taught it is. It's the way we experience it, as opposed to how how our lives are explained for us through the narratives of the corporate media and the educational system controlled by the capitalists and so on. But also getting into, into socialism as a methodology, you know, based on Marxism, where things are put into a context of continual change, you know, dialectics, and also based in a scientific context, a measurable material basis to reality, rather than just ideas floating around or, you know, supernatural, including supernatural ideas floating around as the meaning and engine or impulse for everything that is happening around us or happening to us. So dialectical materialism combined a methodological method of analysis and a guide to political action, at least, could be more than that for many, many scientists influenced by dialectical materialism. That is a way to figure out what's going on, to put things in context, like, for example, violence, which we'll get into or gun violence, especially as we'll get into when we talk about the protests that are happening right now on today's show. So again, if you're just tuning in, this is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, and we're here every other week. And as usual, we have much more to talk about than we have showtime, believe it or not. Our 2 hours goes by extremely fast, even when I don't have a co-host or interview subject or multiple co-hosts, as sometimes is the case. And I think I'm going to throw another song on really quick because there's another piece of paperwork, so to speak, computer work I have to fill out for the show. So we're going to give a listen to a song that was once quite controversial, or an album that was quite controversial around the time of 9-1-1 or right after. Steve Earle, a sort of country rock, is that accurate, singer, came out with an album called Jerusalem, and this is the title cut, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. Jerusalem by Steve Earle, and I've been throwing out some music here. From his album Jerusalem. I've been throwing out some music here earlier in the show than normal because of the incessant need to fill out information here while on air, which I'm kind of getting to dislike a little bit. I've never had a problem with it before, but I'm like, it's interrupting my flow and things are dropping and so on. Hold on a second.
Ah, yes.
That was my phone. So a little piece of equipment not working, a little piece of computerese to fill out, and apparently that's really kind of irritating. So we are going to get into the heart of things today, talking about the big rallies that just happened, and what is kind of a socialist angle on these. First of all, basically they're great. I mean, basically it's really good, really excellent that so many youth are out protesting against gun violence, school violence, and so on. When you get into the details and some of the solutions and how it's being channeled and so on, then it gets a little more problematic. But we can get into that. First, the positives. These are being called by the corporate media the biggest youth-led or youth-initiated protests since the anti-Vietnam War protests. And that's interesting. That's great if that's true in terms of numbers. I'm not sure I agree with the paradigm. I think if you look back at the very early anti-Vietnam War protests, they were actually not just led by or initiated by youth. There were people organizing against the war before it became known and on the radar of the corporate media back then, back in the 60s. And there were all sorts of groups, not technically youth, individuals as well, that were involved in early anti-war protests and organizing. And many of them coming from the civil rights movement at the time, coming from, peace movements, anti-nuclear war movements, and so on. And that was especially true in Europe as well. So I think it's a little misleading to talk about that. And we have this thing in the United States, just a quick digression, or hopefully quick. We have this thing in the United States where we associate political activity from a progressive angle, at least. We associate it with with youth, actually, with younger people, and I think there's there's material reasons for that, concrete reasons for that, because the anti-Vietnam War movement and many of the movements that came out of it were, in fact, had a really high youth component in them, that was the last mass movement in U.S. history, and I mean really mass movement. I'm not, there have been very important and good movements since then. Most recently, the upsurge in women's rights with the big women's marches, the Me Too movement, and so on, with Black Lives Matter after Ferguson, and at times since then, the anti-globalization movement, the Occupy movement after the anti-globalization movement, Occupy movement around 2012. There have been some really important movements that have pushed things forward in many ways, and yet they were not just sort of, in terms of their impact on society, their longevity, and so on, they weren't truly mass movements. If you want to know the criteria I'm sort of using here or that others have used, you would look at just numbers, basically, but also changes that happened, how threatened the system felt, and so on. And I would argue that the mass movements that we've experienced in the United States are largely the most recent, the anti-Vietnam War movements, and the movements that came out of that, like the women's movement, environmental movement, and so on. And they didn't start there, but they were propelled forward. They grew rapidly out of the anti-Vietnam War movement and unleashed a lot of other really good movements. The revolt of the troops within the Vietnam War that people don't really know much about. and that came out of that as well. Now, before that, the civil rights movement, right, and the Black Power movement, if you look at a long period of time from early 50s all the way into the late 60s, early 70s, I think there's a continuum there of pretty constant mass movements happening in the inner cities and in certain in the South, definitely, of course, and so on, that you could call a truly mass movement. Now, did that hit wide sections of the white population, so-called white population around the country? Yes and no. It hit their consciousness, I think, but as far as direct involvement, no. Obviously not, except for certain key moments, March on Washington and others, where there was a large union participation and so on, and certainly behind the scenes there was a lot more union participation and so on, of unions that were at the time primarily led by white leaders, and that's a whole other story, the sort of hidden history of the civil rights movement. But by and large, of course, it was a black liberation movement led by black leaders. But it had a huge effect on consciousness beyond, obviously, the black population. It tore down Jim Crow apartheid in the South. It tore down a lot of unjust laws, or at least temporarily tore down a lot of unjust laws, and opened up, obviously, a lot of institutions like higher education and so on to more of the black working class. And then before that, the mass union movements of the Depression in the 1930s, which were truly of a mass character at a certain point. And it wasn't just unions, it was sort of radicalized movements for social welfare rights, for, what they called relief at the time, for housing, but also for union rights, that translated into a lot of changes for social welfare benefits. And these were truly, the ones I'm mentioning were truly mass movements, and there were others going back further in U.S. society. But, what's that point? And it is a gray area, that point where you say, yeah, this really affected tens of millions of people, versus, say, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands. And we're not talking about that for any reasons of sophistry or academic doublespeak or whatever. We're just to make things less clear. We're trying to actually be more clear and say, because if a mass movement will have a more of a long term effect on everything from politics to culture in U.S. society or any society we're talking about, and we could be on the cusp of a mass movement of a certain, that could bring in different movements or be one, be focused on one main issue or something. I'm not, saying that was a mass movement sort of thing in the past, just the opposite, actually. We're going to see more, I think, in the future. And that's one of the very positive things about the school violence or pro gun control movement that you're seeing now. Socialist Alternative has been active in helping to organize some of these events in some areas and participate in them in others. We have a leaflet put out that says, quote, "We demand an end to the, we need to stop the NRA and pass gun control measures, but the change we need doesn't stop there. We demand an end to all the underlying causes of violence in our society, an end to all forms of inequality and oppression, including sexism and racism, and at the root of it all, capitalism. Join us for this important discussion on strategy to build," and I'm quoting from a leaflet for a public meeting, "join us for the important discussion on strategy to build the anti-gun violence movement and why we need to fight for socialism." And there's some demands that we've been highlighting, and some of these will sound familiar. Ban the sale of assault weapons, for example. Background check the politicians, all NRA and corporate money out of politics. Demilitarize the police. Now, here's where it gets into some demands you might not have associated with this movement. Demilitarize the police. Stop the racist violence against black and brown communities. Medicare for all. Mental and physical health care is a human right. Tax the rich and big business to fully fund our schools. Guns are not school supplies. Organize walkouts for April 20th. So that's one, that very last one, I just want to sort of get, out there. There is going to be more protests, most likely. That's good. Including a walkout on April 20th. In fact, Socialist Alternative has published a pamphlet, it's actually a leaflet, How to Organize a Walkout, written by a socialist alternative member and student who organized anti-Trump walkouts at her high school. And this was in the Boston area, I believe, originally. It's just like a 1, 2, 3, how to organize a walkout. And actually, let's just get into that for a second, because a lot of the protests so far, tactically, have been school walkouts. The first round, I think, was March 20th, I believe, where there was, I might have the date wrong, March 14th, 1 million students across the country walked out. That includes in Boston and in Worcester and a lot of places around where the show is emanating from. And there was a lot of high school walkouts, most of which were allowed, but some weren't. I've gotten stuff on Facebook from student groups involved in this issue, where people were punished, students were punished for walking out, which is kind of, when you just get down to the sort of like material, I don't know, I keep using that word material, and you probably don't understand the way I'm using it. I'm using it sort of as a shorthand for a measurable, scientific, rational way of looking at something. Why can't students walk out of their schools? I mean, schools are not corporations, or they're not supposed to be, especially from the view of the students, right? The students can choose to study or not study. And of course, there are laws that say if you're under 16 in the United States, you have to be in school. But that's in general. I mean, you walk out. I mean, I would find some wiggle room in that law and say, well, what do you mean? I'm supposed to be in school all the time. I can't, some schools allow me to go out and get lunch somewhere else, or allow me to go home if I'm sick, or allow me to walk around after school, you know? I mean, so school's ending a little early today. We're going to go protest. I mean, you know, whatever. There's got to be some room there to not be... That's for school not to be a prison, basically, or for school not to be a workplace, which in some ways are like prisons. So that's very, very important. And students are rightly taking advantage of that and organizing walkouts. And I don't know how long the tolerance of the administrators will last, if that, you know, because like I said, there has been a general, not total at all, but general tolerance for some of these walkouts. Even to the point, unfortunately, oddly enough, of administrators or people linked to the administrators or linked to the power structure in certain cities organizing protests, taking it out of the hands of the students. That happened in Worcester to a certain extent, unfortunately. And that's not good. People say, well, the energy of the youth. Yeah, that's very important. The energy of the youth is the strength that youth have, but it's also the ideas of the youth. Don't sell your children short, basically. They have ideas, they have brains, and I think millennials or the youth, I don't like that term so much, but whatever, the youth today are, because of their experience of lowering living standards, because of their experience of movements, again, not necessarily mass movements, but movements that I think have an effect, like Black Lives Matter and Occupy and so on. Well, some of them are too young for Occupy now, but these are things that are going to impact their consciousness and form their consciousness, and it's forming a more radicalized consciousness. I mean, it's almost inevitable. It's forming a more radicalized consciousness. Now, if there isn't a socialist movement out there, a big socialist movement, a growing socialist movement, which, you know, there really isn't yet, although the beginnings of it are there and we're part of that, then you can't, you don't know how these... energy and change in consciousness are going to, what direction they're going to go in, unfortunately. And that's a problem. And, everyone from the far right to the Democratic Party will try to channel student protest in a non-progressive way, in a way that won't get at the roots of the problem and so on. But, you know, tactically speaking, before we get into that more, tactically speaking, it's been a great movement so far. The walkouts at first done without, you know, any permission, I would think, a lot of them. And then done because the administrators feeling the weight of the movement, so to speak, the numbers involved, the concern, basically saying, yeah, you can walk out when normally they wouldn't. How long that will last remains to be seen. So, you know, we put out this little leaflet, how to do a walkout. The ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, don't need to say that fast, they have information also about student walkouts and what your rights are. Let me just read a few excerpts from this one, How to Organize a Walkout, written by social alternative member and student who organized anti-Trump walkouts at her high school. Oh, yeah, that brings me to something. This is going to sound interesting. I mean, this is going to sound, I hope it's going to be interesting. No, that's not what I meant to say. This is going to sound, I'm not sure you've thought of this analogy, let's put it this way, but maybe some activists have. I want to get it out there. The anti-Trump walkouts that happened, some of them were big, some of them were huge, but the corporate media was completely hostile to them for the most part. And the anti-Trump walkouts were met, was around in Worcester, the anti-Trump walkouts from schools were met with complete hostility and threats, very vicious threats, even the use of police to stop them in Worcester, Massachusetts, for example. And the walkouts were not that successful as a result in Worcester. And they were, you know, we had members of Social Alternative that were trying to lead some of those. And vicious repression, you know, and a lot of fear from then, therefore, from parents and students about walking out. And of course, not everyone hated Trump, unfortunately, or hated Trump getting elected. So you had a smaller subset of people to work from, but still a very large subset, especially in a place like Worcester, a very large subset of students that high school students and others that disliked Trump enough to, yes, wanting to walk out. And then the closer the day of the walkout got, more and more threats from the administration for everything from detention to losing credit to, you know, to you know, even a possibility of arrest by the police and an invisible police presence in front of high schools. They say it's a free country. Don't believe them. we have a lot of examples of that here on Social Alternative Radio. So anyway, but still, walkouts persisted, but a completely different attitude and mood towards them. You know, the corporate media attacked the walkouts against Trump. Bottom line is, even there's obviously there's elements in the corporate media that don't like Trump, but they will defend the system, you know, to their last advertising dollar or their last Koch brothers donation if you're NPR, and they won't see movements get going that could threaten the system. The anti-gun movements, the pro-gun control movements, they are by contrast, they are being coddled and promoted and cheerleaded by the corporate media. And that should give all of us a pause, you know? We should think about that. I mean, as I said in the beginning, these movements are by and large extremely positive and really good, and Social Alternative is supportive and participating in them to the extent that we can. And they're great, great things coming out of the movements. And on the ground, the reception of the students to Social Alternative has been great. And we had one school administrator threaten to call the cops on us in Minneapolis and Minnesota. And we said, basically, go ahead. Never happened. It's a big movement. And the ruling class is desperately trying to keep a rein on it and to channel it in certain directions. All you have to do is vote Democrat or just vote, and somehow magically that will turn into gun control legislation that will get rid of school violence, school gun violence, and get rid of gun violence in society as a whole. Not true, obviously, but you know that is the way that the I think the police had nothing but nice things to say about the protests, like, for example, here in Boston, which were really big and really, really good. But the police were, this is great. No one got arrested. They didn't arrest anybody. They just, the chief of police just is giving this high, high praise and cheerleading to the whole protest. That also should give you pause, because the reality in the United States is that police shootings have killed many more people than, especially youth, than the mass shootings have that make the school shootings and so on. And, both, obviously we have to, stop, but that's just the reality of it. So if the police are cheering on your, pro gun control protest, it's at least worth stopping and not stopping the protest, but stopping and thinking for a second why they would do that. What is their aim? Why do they, where do they want to channel this movement? If the school administrators and Democratic Party elites are cheering on the movement, what for? What do they want to use it for? That's very important to think about. At a more grassroots level, students walking out, students putting forward demands, which by and large are pretty good. And then extending the movement, building the movement, that's very important. And to help that along, just a few points again in this leaflet about high school walkouts. Question one, legitimize. What can I do to legitimize this walkout in the eyes of my classmates? And I'm just reading excerpts here. You can try to get in touch with the administrators and get the walkout seen as an absence like any other. That should be able to excuse it with a note or makeup or something if necessary. They cannot legally punish a student for exercising the right to assemble or freedom of speech. It may help to include students' rights in the details of the Facebook event page. It also helps to have the event page up at least a few days before the walkout so students have a chance to discuss it with their parents. These are like all under the, you know, and I would add to this, having as many people involved as possible obviously helps legitimize it. Having my students involved as possible and willing to speak up at the administration. And that has been so overwhelming lately that most administrations, as we said earlier, are backing off from punishing the students, although some have done that anyway. Second is to build the walkout. This is starting with student groups, if possible, if they exist, social media platforms, as many as possible. Classmates will take the idea more seriously when they see their friends put the details on their Snapchat stories or their timeline. Using social media basically. And it also allows people on social media to get questions answered, easily share details with other schools, generally plan outside of the view of authority, meaning the school authority, the administrations, the cops, and so on. It's also important to try to connect with students who have an audience at your school, presidents of relevant clubs, teams, who can help spread the words about their members and sort of sanction, quote-unquote, the event on the club level. See if these student leaders will share info about the walkout at the next club meeting. Organizing a meeting among high school leaders from different schools to help broaden the walkout and clarify the specific demands that are being made. The more unified the strategy and message, the more prepared we will be for news interviews or even criticism from family or teachers. And it helps to have, the walkout itself helps to have somewhere the students can meet beforehand and walk to the rally together. So is there a field or a parking lot space to be off campus that can even be a block off campus and people and students will still know where it is and be able to get to it, but in full view of the school even would be better. Some may make a last minute choice to join some students after seeing their friends gather. Walking out at the beginning of a fourth or fifth period means students have the chance to join in after school. If there's a class they cannot miss, obviously the impact is greater the more classes are missed, but more students are likely to participate if they don't have to miss the whole day. Students should be in contact with those from other schools so that they can wait up if one of the school arrives at the designated meeting place before others. A group chat is usually effective. And then this is very important, highlighted on this leaflet. After the walkouts, keep up the energy by organizing a socialist students club at your school where you can meet and discuss things like current events and where you can organize to win change at your school and in broader society. Now, why are walkouts important? This is how the leaflet ends. It's put out by socialist students also socialist alternative. Students have played a central role in social movements from civil rights to anti-war efforts to countering the rise of nationalist hate under the Trump administration. High school students are typically too young to vote or strike, so walkouts are one of the only ways that we can disrupt business as usual. It's also an excellent opportunity for us to connect with like-minded peers, learn how to make bold demands of our school, local, and national government, and practice dealing with finger-wagging authorities. Most importantly, walkouts are a first step for us in building a movement to change the world. And on that note, I'll just segue into, is everyone on this march, trying to change the world? Everyone on these marches? Well, it depends. I mean, I think that some people, some students would argue and others, non-students would argue that, to have a country like the United States that's so violent, to significantly lessen violence in general, and especially gun violence, would be changing things drastically. And I would agree with that. That is a major change, not to be belittled or made light of. That would be a huge, huge change. The question then, I think, becomes, is focusing on more gun control laws going to stop general propensity towards violence in U.S. society, or even gun violence in the short term, or even long term, actually? And what are some pitfalls that have happened in the past, some dangers of that? And also, as you may have seen, there's sort of this little bit of a word getting out, even in the corporate media, I've noticed that, this issue is a little different in neighborhoods of people of color, in communities of color, so to speak, where it's the violence of the police that is really one of the main problems, and they're hearing out of and of course there's tons of gun violence too, but what they're hearing from the sort of mainstream of the pro-gun control movement right now is things like more cops in the schools and that sort of thing. And so there's this countervailing, like we put forward in Social Alternative, demilitarize the police, but stop the violence, racist violence against black and brown communities. We also put in other places that, you know, putting police in the schools, that we put this demand in other formats. Putting police in the schools is not the answer. Arming the teachers is not the answer. I think arming the teachers is not a very popular demand. That's a kind of Trumpism. But there is an idea of more cops in the schools out there. And that would, if you want to start getting into the negative category of the protest, I think that would be one. I think also, and this is a little a subtler point, but one that we've made before, that I think is extremely important, is that, you know, in most of the time I've been active politically, the shorthand was, are you for gun control or are you against gun control? And that was always kind of wrong, you know, kind of misleading. I've never met anyone that was against every aspect of gun control in reality, even so-called gun nuts or people that are into guns and so on. And I think there is a legitimate a right to own guns personally. I think that people can own them for target shooting and for hunting and, you know, for self-defense even in certain situations. And that to criminalize all guns would result in mass incarceration on steroids. You would just be having so many people that would never, just statistically never, are engaged in any kind of gun violence, but yet have access to weapons, rounded up, and it would just be an incredible criminalization of a huge section of society. By the way, not just the so-called, you know, white, section of the working class or whatever. This would encompass many, many people of color and many, many women, actually, and many, many people throughout the country. And there are countries, by the way, with comparable levels of gun ownership, but don't have the gun violence, mass shootings, school shootings, and all that problem, mass murder problems that the United States has. So obviously, things point to a deeper reasons here. And if you leave those reasons off, and only address the tools of gun violence, and don't see any legitimate reason for anyone to own a gun, then that's where it gets murky. That's how the thing got polarized to begin with. And I'm not, polarized isn't always bad, but I'm just saying the gun control, I'm for gun control or I'm against gun control. Whereas I never met anyone that was for, absolutely no gun control, you know, like the whole thing about the, assault weapons. We're for a ban on assault weapons. I would argue most gun owners are too, just from my personal experience. And I think there's polling data on that now as well. So what's the big deal there? But I'll tell you where the big deal is with people that own guns. I don't own guns, but I'm just saying I grew up in that environment. The big deal is that you can easily find people involved in this issue that are including the rallies that have just happened, that say, I saw a woman, maybe it's not her fault, she was a young woman who was quoted by the corporate media. You never know when the corporate media does to your quotes. I've been quoted in the corporate media before at events And things that I've spoken at and so on. And I look at my quotes the next day and I'm like, well, I never said that, sorry. And you have to figure out how you're going to write in to try to get a retraction. It gets very complicated. And basically, the corporate media is extremely inaccurate, believe it or not. Big surprise in quoting people and their facts and so on. So I hope you're not surprised by that. But anyway, so maybe she was misquoted, but she basically said, now, I don't know why people would want to hang on to their guns instead of support, like, you know, school safety or support, like, a peaceful society or something. It was a very broad statement. That's what I'm getting at, a very wide-ranging statement. And that's where people that either own guns or see that the need for the right to own guns is legitimate in a lot of ways, that they are like, well, okay, so you're for banning all weapons. That's not one of the demands I've heard out of this movement. You know, what's the deal, you know? And that's a very easy thing to, like, let's take, for example, background checks. Well, you know, you had the chief of police in Boston, again, the one that was cheerleading along with the corporate media, these big protests. And again, you got to, let's just figure out why that is a little bit. And really emphasizing the background check thing. Now, background checks give the police a lot of information. Now, I'm for background checks in terms of gun ownership. Social Alternative is for background checks with gun ownership. But there's got to be a way to appeal those checks. There's got to be limits, and the ACLU talks about this too, to the way that information is used, right? If you just start, police love collecting data, all sorts of data. They had in Boston, they had a police unit collecting social media data. I think that was shut down after a time, but that was there. You know, so I really wonder, I don't wonder, but I really don't like, you know, whether it's the issue of gun control or any other issue where liberals especially, but also conservatives, of course, of all sorts, plenty of Republicans, the hidden secret is they support gun control as well, especially the ones close to the police or close to the military. They support gun control. They don't see any, they want everyone not to have a weapon, and they just want to have the weapons for the, you know, for their institutions. They want militarized police, highly militarized. They want to be able to use troops in controlling social unrest, quote unquote, in the United States. That's, you know, there's no, you can't, this is not exactly Republican Democratic dichotomy here, except you will have more Republicans trying to use the issue of gun control to gain votes. In the way I'm trying to get at, and by saying that, oh, those gun control people, they're all for banning weapons entirely. No, that's not the case. I think the demands that have come out of this movement so far have been pretty good overall. But there is that ambiguity that's out there. There is that demonization of anyone that might want to engage in anything to do with shooting or hunting or self-defense or whatever. There's a real kind of, unfortunately, short-sighted historically faith in the capitalist state. Oh, they'll take care of everything. Just give more and more power to the police, more and more power to the capitalist state, and everything will be fine. We won't have gun violence. And, you know, at a certain level, that might be true at some point in history. I think it's much more complicated than that, given the amount of guns that have been produced by capitalist companies, by the way, for profit. That's why the country's flooded with guns. It's not because people voted to, you know, hey, today we're going to vote on producing 1 million guns instead of, you know, free higher education. You know, that doesn't come to a vote under capitalism, right? The capitalists put out what they think they can make a profit out of. If you did a history, like say a Marxist history of gun production in the United States, it would be directly linked to repressive measures against, you know, slaves, against Native Americans, against working people, against the civil rights movement, against, you know, et cetera. And it also gets complicated in that there were times historically where working people, whether it's the early union movement or the fighting against the KKK and fighting against the violence of Jim Crow, the lynching and so on, where working people had to arm themselves for collective self-defense against racist and fascist movements. You know, and nobody wants to talk about that now, but it's an absolute fact. And if you think that with someone, if you haven't noticed, the right wing has been emboldened by the election of Trump, and it's gotten a lot of, unfortunately, since the socialist movement isn't big enough, it's gotten some people involved in the right wing movement that are just desperate, you know, And as a corresponding, like in Charlottesville, for example, the murder of a protester by a Nazi, and so on. There's this, you know, increasing right wing violence. Okay, guns or bombs or whatever the choice of weapon is, baseball bats or whatever, and that is there and that is real. And to say to people in those communities that have to defend themselves against that, or to say that to that to activists that have to defend themselves against that, that you have no right to any sort of weapon to defend yourself. I'm sorry, that's just not the reality that unfortunately we're faced with. And if a lot of the corporations are pumping out guns, and you know, and as it's you know, this system is awash in weapons, not because people voted for it to be that way. It is there. And how do you deal with it? Yes, you deal with it with gun control measures, but gun control measures to the point of banning weapons, where then all of a sudden it turns into a way to prevent people from legitimately owning any kind of guns. I would argue no. A lot of people are arguing no. I'm not saying the movement is saying that. It's not. The movement's been pretty careful. I've seen March for Our Lives and so on. They don't put that forward. However, there is the sort of demonization of all gun owners that happens, and then there's statements here and there that lead people that are nervous about a banning of all weapons, that are nervous about increased police powers, increased police militarization, let's say, increased police powers, and increased, and I'm not talking about right wing, I'm talking about people that are progressive or on the left, nervous about that, increased powers of the state, taking away a right, however much it needs to be regulated or whatever, that gets into some problems. And also the sort of idea that, again, to lower gun violence, to eliminate mass school shootings, which really didn't start till the 90s under Columbine, you might want to ask yourself, what is there a correlation between increased inequality, increased deregulation of capitalism in general? You know, they don't want to regulate corporations, but they want to regulate the hell out of guns, you know?